Caius by Withershins. Part 1 of the Mutant AU series. Fandom, Hockey RPF. Relationship, Sidney Crosby of Jenny Malkin. Summary: on the government's classified mutant register and on the NHL's records, Sidney is listed as Sidney Patrick Crosby, Nova Scotia, Canada, Class 2. Death visions, skin contact required. Author's notes, not set during any specific X-Men canon. Warnings. 1. Brief description of a character experiencing death but not actually dying. And 2. Mutant phobic hate directed at a child. 2004 to 2006. About a month before Sidney's 17th birthday, the NHL drafts not one but two mutants, and both of them first-round picks. They're both Russian, which isn't necessarily a surprise. Russia is one of the first countries to let mutants onto Major League ice. While most North American mutants tend to give up hockey early, knowing they're never going to get a shot at the NHL, beaten by the system before they even started. And they're both good, the Russians. Ovechkin, sure, Sidney doesn't blame the hype generated around the guy, but the one who really catches his interest is Malkin. He's like a shark on the ice. So fast, so unexpectedly deadly as he prowls around and snaps up blink-of-the-eye chances, it's mesmerizing. But honestly, Sidney wouldn't care if the guys had the worst hands in the league. There are mutants in the NHL. The day the news breaks, he's hit by a wash of joy so fierce he almost blacks out. Fuck yeah! Language, Sidney, his mom says, but unless there's an echo in the TV room, his dad is just as guilty as he is, so Sidney doesn't feel too bad. As if he could feel bad about anything right now. Mutants in the NHL. It's everything he's been betting on when he refused to be cowed, year after year, as the pressure kept mounting for him to get off the ice, Muty. We don't want your kind. You'll never make it anywhere anyway. He gets a text from Jack that night. Dude, what did I tell ya? Is all it says. And Sidney doesn't stop grinning for an hour after he sees it. Jack is a human, but when they'd been playing together, he'd always been unrelentingly friendly and accepting towards Sidney. When the rest of the guys, once they saw the black band on his wrist, were wary and kept their distance. Jack and Sidney made a wager that season. Jack betting that mutants would be in the NHL before their draft year, and Sidney guessing that 2005 would roll around and still be an all-human league. He's never been more happy to owe someone push-ups in his life. Malkin's and Ovechkin's mutations aren't released to the public, in accordance with the Revised Registration Act of 1995. But in the pictures, Sidney can see their black wristbands sitting tight around their wrists. He wonders if the bands feel weird to them, or if they've gotten used to them yet. Russia doesn't require its mutants to be visibly marked, but for those that want to play in the U.S. or Canada, they'll have to follow the rules. Sidney's very familiar with the rules. He's had to be, so as not to give someone an excuse to chuck him out of hockey altogether. But all of that, all the vitriol he's faced, all the skittish teammates, all the time he had to prove he was worth the risk of letting him step onto the ice with the other kids, none of it matters, because mutants are in the NHL. Then the lockout happens, and it keeps happening all year. Sidney's only consolation is that Jack now owes him push-ups. Hey, what? Jack yelps when Sidney remembers to tell him this, while they're lying around their shared room in Ottawa draft week. I won that bet. Ovechkin and Malkin, those names ring any bells? The exact terms of the bet were that mutants would be playing in the NHL by the time we had our draft year. And Malkin and Ovechkin haven't really played yet, right? Jack shoves him off the bed, and the whole thing winds up into a friendly scuffle on the floor. No one does push-ups. If there's one thing better than getting drafted as a mutant and going to the Pittsburgh Penguins and Evgeny Malkin, it's having Mario Lemieux invite him to live with his family. Sidney half expected someone to jump out with a camera and laugh at him for falling for the biggest prank of the year. "You know I'm a mutant, right?" Sidney asked like an idiot. Of course Lemieux knows. He knows better than anyone. Even if he'd managed to miss the glaringly obvious wristband Sidney wears, the whole world knows the Penguins drafted one of those people. Lemieux smiles. "We've been made aware," he says wryly. Sidney lowers his voice. "And you do know what my mutation is?" This is another stupid question. He had to declare the basic specifics of his mutation at the scouting combine, so that any team looking at him would know what they were getting with him. They couldn't tell the public without his permission, but they knew. "Yes, we've been informed of what your mutation can do," Lemieux said. He looks confused now. "Is something about that worrying you?" Sidney rubs his hair awkwardly. "Most people, they aren't exactly comfortable spending a lot of time around me when they find out," he explains, feeling this should be obvious. "So I understand if you'd rather I stay somewhere else. I won't be offended. I mean, you'll already be seeing a lot of me at games and practices and stuff." An odd expression crosses Lemieux's face, followed by unexpected gentleness and certainty. "The offer stands," he says. "We'd love to have you stay with us." And Sidney's not so much of an idiot that he'd turn down a Mario Lemieux who's apprised of the circumstances and still wants him in his house. "That'd be really great," he accepts, beaming wide enough to light the room, he's sure. "Thank you so much." Lemieux smiles and holds out a hand to shake, and, after the barest hesitation, Sidney takes it. Across his mind, he sees a flash of someone leaning over a bed. Lemieux's wife, he thinks. But it's unfocused and grayish and gone less than a second later. He tries to keep his expression schooled and not let on that he saw anything. "Ah," Lemieux says. He releases Sidney's hand, but not like he's freaked out. Just a natural end to the handshake. "Does it happen every time you touch someone?" Sidney puts his hands in his pockets. "Not every time. It's strongest the first time I touch someone, and after, changes," he adds, hoping that Lemieux won't ask him to clarify. But Lemieux doesn't look disturbed or curious, just a little concerned. "Oh," Sidney realizes. "Don't worry, I didn't see anything distinct in yours. That usually means it's a long way off." People typically look relieved when Sidney tells them that, but if anything, Lemieux looks more worried. "Sidney," he says, and Sidney tenses. Maybe the freakout was just delayed. But Lemieux's eyes are soft and searching. "You don't need to share anything about your gift that you don't want to, but if you ever want someone to talk to, even if you just want someone to listen while you rant, you can come to me." Thank you, Sidney says weakly, too stunned at hearing someone call it a gift to put himself together and respond properly. He thinks about the conversation later that night, as he's waiting to fall asleep. He doubts Lemieux, Mario, as he'd been told to call him, what is Sidney's life, really meant what he was offering. He didn't think he was lying, of course, but he probably didn't fully understand what he was asking. Most people don't like talking or thinking about death. Sidney is in the best position to know that firsthand. It's obvious from the way they flinch away from his touch, or the way they ask, voices fearful and tight, what he'd seen when their skin had touched. Sidney rarely tells people what he's seen. Usually, thankfully, he doesn't see anything worth telling. But when he does, they don't really want to know. They'd rather pretend everything is okay. He realized this first when he was 6 years old and he'd warned Mrs. Thornton down the street that she was going to have a heart attack in 7 days. He knew because he'd seen it when she bent down and pinched his cheek hello. The vision of her alone, late at night, her breath coming short and her hands pressed to the middle of her chest. In the vision, no one had found her body until 3 days later. Mrs. Thornton had died the day after he'd told her. She should have had another week, but the knowledge of what was coming had worried her into an early heart attack. Distraught, Sidney had fled to his mom and told her it was his fault that he had killed Mrs. Thornton. He'd only been trying to help, had only told her so she wouldn't be alone when she died like in the vision. But instead he'd killed her. "No, baby," his mom had said to him when she'd gotten the whole story out of him. "It wasn't your fault. We can't always know what will happen with the choices we make. But we just have to make the best decisions we can with the information we have at the time. You wanted to help. That's what's important." But Sidney had been inconsolable for weeks. He'd learned then that unless there was a way to delay it, people didn't want to know how or when they'd die. Deaths aren't guaranteed. Just because Sidney sees a particular death vision doesn't mean it's definitely happening that way. People change their plans, make new decisions, and just like that, the future changes. Sidney had once had a coach who, for years, had had the sort of uncolored, indistinct death vision that meant their passing was decades away. Then one day, the coach had decided to take his wife and kids to Disneyland, and on the way there, his car had rolled and been T-boned by oncoming traffic. The wife and kids had lived. Coach hadn't. Sidney hadn't known it was coming. The last time he'd brushed against Coach's skin had been before the trip had been planned. He had still thought Coach was going to die sometime in the hazy, far-off future. He had learned then that the future rarely gave up its secrets, even to him. On the government's classified mutant register, and on the NHL's private records, Sidney is listed as Sidney Patrick Crosby, Nova Scotia, Canada, Class 2, Death Visions, Skin Contact Required. It's mostly accurate. The first time Sidney had deliberately used his mutation to prevent a death, he'd been 10 years old. It was then that he'd discovered that if the person was near enough and their death was imminent enough, he didn't require skin-on-skin contact to have a vision at all. He'd been keeping an eye on Taylor while their mom stepped out to pick cucumbers from the garden. Taylor had been on the floor playing blocks, and he'd been on the couch doing homework. Then, without anyone's hand on him, he'd dropped straight into the sharpest, most vibrantly colored vision he'd ever seen. In 1 minute, Taylor would clamber to her feet, toddle over to the bookcase and clench her tiny hands on one of the shelves, and the heavy clock precariously atop the bookcase would fall and split her head open. Sidney had moved faster than he had ever moved on the ice. He scooped Taylor up and hauled her back to the couch where he'd wrapped all his limbs around her and waited for the seconds to count down, ignoring her fussing at him to, "Let go! Let go! Wanna go play?" When the moment of her could-have-been death had arrived, Sidney had uncovered a new aspect of his mutation. If he uses his visions to prevent someone's death that otherwise would have happened, he experiences it in their place. Not physically, his body isn't harmed, but mentally, almost like one of his visions. He's since learned that it's called death possession, or sometimes death repossession. And that's exactly what it feels like. When he'd repossessed Taylor's death the exact second it would have occurred, he'd seen it through her eyes, like he was her. He'd felt the hot, wet crack of the clock over his head, the unlucky slice of broken glass against his neck as he fell to the ground, the seeping darkness that ate the pain. It was like being possessed by the death itself. When it had finally ended, he'd opened his eyes and found that his dad was kneeling next to him, hovering over him, face pale and scared. Taylor was gone. "Taylor!" he yelled, shooting up from the couch, but his dad had stopped him with a hand on his shoulder. "Your mom took her to the other room. Just rest for a minute, bud. You're gonna be okay. We've got an ambulance coming." Sidney sank back onto the couch. "She's okay, Taylor? She's not... not dead?" "She's fine. Just rest now, okay?" His dad's words registered then. "I don't need an ambulance," he protested, and his dad had stroked his hair soothingly. "Don't worry. It'll be fine. You're as white as a sheet, Sidney, and when we found you, you wouldn't wake up, even when Taylor was crying right next to your ear for who knows how long. They're going to just look you over, okay? See if you need to go to the hospital." "No," Sidney had said. "It wasn't... I'm okay. It wasn't anything. It was a... mutation thing." His dad's hand had stopped stroking his hair, pausing heavy against his head.
"You had a vision? Are you okay?"
"I don't think it was a vision. I think it was something else."
"We'll figure it out," his dad had promised. "We'll find someone safe to talk to about it."
"Okay, but first could we move that clock somewhere else?" They had gotten rid of the clock entirely. The ambulance people had been very nice about the false call, asking if they wanted them to look over Sydney just in case, at least until they caught a glance of the band around Sydney's wrist. They'd been a lot less friendly and warm then, and one had crossed herself as they'd left. "Little muty freak," another had muttered, not caring Sydney was near enough to hear him. He'd learned then that even using his mutation for something good couldn't make people like him for it. But still, he'd been 10 years old and he'd saved his sister from dying. He'd known better than to tell just anyone about that, but he'd still been young enough to want to share it with someone. So he'd told his friend from school, a friend who, his own sister, was a mutant, and had never cared about the black band on anyone's wrist.
"Wait," his friend had said, a weird look on his face after Sydney had shared the story. "You actually, like, see people dying? Whenever you touch them?"
He hadn't taken a step back from Sydney, but it suddenly had felt like there was twice as much space between them as before.
That's really strange."
His friend had never seemed quite comfortable around him again, until the day Sydney realized the word friend didn't really apply anymore. He'd learned then to be more careful about who he told about his mutation. Since Taylor, Sydney had only repossessed someone's death one other time. It was a little boy he didn't know, who had run out into traffic and gotten himself flattened by a bus. Sydney had barely even felt that death when it possessed him, but it had still taken him 5 minutes to wake up from it. No one had called the ambulance that time. As he drifted to sleep, Sydney wondered if Malkin had ever hated being a mutant. What can he do? Does he like it? Is it useful? Is it something random, like the girl Sydney had met once that was able to make her hair and nails, only hair and nails, disappear at will? He knows it can't be anything like super strength, anything that could be judged to give Malkin an edge on the ice, or he wouldn't be allowed to play. But beyond that, Sydney's got no idea what it could be. He'll have to wait and ask him in September. But Sydney doesn't get a chance to ask that season, because Malkin stays and plays for Metallurg another year. The only mutants on the NHL ice this year will be Sydney and Ovechkin, and already the media's trying to pit them against each other in some sort of rivalry no one consulted Sydney about. He hasn't even met the guy yet, and the press is already writing their story for them. "Is it because we're both mutants?" he asks Mario one day, shortly after he's moved in.
"Only in part, probably," Mario answers. "But I think even without the mutant angle, they'd do something like this. The best you can do is just limit the ammunition they have to work with." It becomes Sydney's byword for the year, limit the ammunition. He uses it with the media, obviously, but also with the team.
"So, what exactly do you do, anyway?" Army asks him, only a couple of games into the start of the season. All the guys nearest perk up, not so subtly listening in.
"I mean, the whole world knows about Ovechkin's fire mutation. He's not exactly quiet about it. But no one's heard anything about yours. And I'm just going to say up front here that I've got money on it being that huge ass of yours."
Sydney laughs and ducks his head, keeping his eyes focused on his own stall.
"Nah, it's not that. I just don't really like talking about my mutation much."
Max leans in on Sid's other side, not bothering to pretend he's not eavesdropping.
"Come on. Not even to us?" he wheedles.
"Is it something weird, like your gas being radioactive? Because I feel like that's the sort of thing we ought to know about our teammates." Sid laughs again, a little more forced this time.
"Nothing like that. It's not anything that can, you know, hurt someone. I just don't like talking about it."
"You guys don't need to worry about it. It's not something that can affect you." He fiddles with his wristband.
Max and Army trade speaking glances, like Sydney isn't right there watching them do it. Max looks like he wants to press the issue. Thankfully, Army speaks up first.
"Hey, man. It's your secret, keep it or not," he tells Sid. "We're not going to pressure you or anything."
"I'm pressuring you," Max mutters, but Mario walks past then and Max backs off. It isn't that Sydney necessarily thinks the team would be awful about it, if they knew about his mutation. It's just that he'd rather not give them the chance in the first place. Maybe if he had any other mutation, it would be different. But as it is, he doesn't want it to become a thing every time he shares a casual touch with a teammate. He doesn't want them flinching away, afraid of what he might see. And he doesn't want them studying his reaction, either, looking for clues every time he brushes skin with someone. It's the sort of thing even the most mutant-friendly human does the first time they find out what he can see. And the guys have been great, they really have. They're already the most overall accepting team he's ever been on, a lot of them clearly taking their lead from Mario. The worst of them are only reserved with him, cautious but never malicious, and the best of them are almost as good as Jack was at the very start. Maybe in time he'll be as comfortable with them as he is with Jack. But even Jack still doesn't know his exact mutation. He's figured out that it's something to do with touch. Even though he's never once pressed for answers, even when they were idiot 15-year-olds. Sydney just prefers people not knowing, especially if he's going to be spending a lot of time with them. Ovechkin, when they finally meet, does not appreciate this viewpoint. He swoops down on Sydney pre-game, just as Sydney's telling the press that no, he and Ovechkin do not have any sort of bizarre animalistic aggression towards each other, like two wolves trying to mark the same territory or something. For fuck's sake, mutants aren't animals. Where do you get this stuff, etc.? He's more bland and diplomatic about it, of course, but that's the general thrust behind his words. That's when Ovechkin finds him.
"Sidney Crosby, as fellow mutant, I have very important question."
All the people still loitering in the room zero in on the two of them like sharks scenting blood, so Sidney grabs Ovechkin's elbow and hauls him somewhere private.
"Good," Ovechkin nods approvingly once they've resettled in a quiet hallway. "It's very serious talk. We don't want interruptions."
"Oh, God," says Sidney. "Okay, what do you want, Ovechkin?"
"First, you call me Alex, okay? Like proper fellow mutant. Or Sasha. Sasha would be best, but Alex is okay. Second, you tell me something. Why don't you talk about your power?"
Sidney fights a grimace. It's just another variation of what he gets from the press all the time. "Exactly what kind of freak are you anyway, Sidney? Why haven't we been able to dig it out of your past yet, like the vultures we are?" But Ovechkin, inexplicably, seems actually bothered, where the press just sounds hungry when they ask.
"I watch and I watch and I wonder, when will Sidney Crosby brag to the world about his gift? But then, there's nothing. You are so quiet, so stubborn. I get annoying texts from annoying Zhenya. What kind of mutant is Sidney Crosby? What kind of power? But I have no answers to tell him. You make me bad friend, Sidney Crosby. You are bad future teammate to poor Zhenya."
Sidney, vacillating between bemused and annoyance, perks up at that.
"Wait, future teammate? Are you talking about Malkin?"
Ovechkin looks down at him, impatiently amused.
"Yes, Zhenya, always Zhenya on my phone. He wants to know about future mutant teammate. So excited to play with you. Understandable, yes. If he can't play with me, Sidney Crosby is next best."
"Ha," Sidney says. Then he screws up his face, torn. On one hand, if ever there was someone he was going to tell about his mutation, it'd be of Jenny Malkin. On the other hand, if ever there was someone he'd trust to carry the message, it definitely wouldn't be Alex Ovechkin.
"Tell Malkin that maybe I'll tell him about it. But when he gets here," Sidney decides at last. There's just no way he feels comfortable sending the information out over a phone, especially a phone in the hands of Ovechkin.
Ovechkin sighs loudly. "If this is best you can do. Okay, I'll tell him this. Now, You tell me about mutation.
I... what?
Tell me about Sidney Crosby mutation. Is it power to make ice? Would be perfect match for me. Perfect rival.
Ovechkin, I just told you. I'll only tell Malkin what my ability is when I see him face to face.
Maybe.
Yes, yes, you tell Zhenya then. Maybe. I understand. But now you tell me. Just for me to know, as fellow mutant.
I'm not... He breaks off and just stares at Ovechkin, disbelieving for a minute.
I'm not going to tell you what my mutation is, he says slowly. Why would I tell you if I'm not even telling Malkin yet?
But why not? Ovechkin protests, looking very put out. Mutation is gift. Should be celebrated. Should be bragged about. And who is better to brag than fellow mutant, right here in front of you?
This isn't Russia, you know that, right? People don't like mutants very much here. And besides, I just don't like talking about it. I don't like people knowing.
Yes, he adds preemptively. Even fellow mutants. Ovechkin narrows his eyes. But you offer to maybe tell Zhenya?
Sidney just shrugs. Malkin's different. He has no idea why, but the idea of telling him isn't as scary as pretty much telling anyone else. Maybe because he's already got Malkin in his head as a potential combination of both a teammate and another mutant, the two things Sidney would trust most. He can't quite put it into words. He's just really looking forward to skating with Malkin, as a hockey player and as a mutant.
Fine, Ovechkin huffs. I'll get truth out of you one day. You'll see. We will be BFFs.
He says it like a threat. That night, Sidney gets 2 points and Ovechkin gets 1. The Penguins get 5 goals and the Capitals get 4. It's not a rivalry, but Sid still feels pretty good walking away from that game. His enjoyment only dims a little when he inexplicably gets a text later that says, "This is Sasha. Save my number so we can be true BFFs."
Sidney saves the number, but only because having information is better than not having it. It's not like anyone has to know he has Ovechkin's number in his phone. Just in case, though, he lists it under a different name. That way, he'll be covered if someone happens to look through his contacts. The season goes on. It's both more than he ever hoped he could have and still not enough. And on top of it all, every day he feels the weight of having to prove mutants are worth it. That they belong in the NHL, just the same as anyone else who can play. All he can do is his best, but he worries it won't be good enough. He wonders if anything would be deemed good enough by the world, predisposed to judge him by the harshest standards. On the ice, he hears every variation of muty out there. Some almost friendly, and most decidedly not. He's read online about how he's overhyped, how he only got into the NHL because they want to look progressive. How he's whiny, a mutie, and he should never have even been allowed to make it into midget. They can't seem to decide if he's a crybaby or a dangerous monster, so they usually go with whatever suits their rhetoric at the time. It wears on him, but he ducks his head and digs in and plays his game. They don't make it into the playoffs, and his critiques get louder and nastier. He retreats to Canada and comes back in August more determined than ever. He meets Evgeny Malkin shortly after his 19th birthday. It almost doesn't happen. It almost looks like it's going to be another year before Malkin will come to the U.S., trapped in a new contract. Until suddenly, Malkin's in Pittsburgh, and Sidney's blindsided with relief. Malkin looks tired and lost, his face creased, all but dead on his feet as he hovers behind Gonch. But his face transforms entirely when he catches sight of where Sid is lurking awkwardly to the side, waiting for Mario to introduce him. Malkin clutches Gonch's arm and shoots off something low and sharp in Russian, his eyes never leaving Sid's, his smile not dimming. Gonch sighs and murmurs something back, then turns to Sidney.
He insists I tell you this, and won't wait for a proper introduction first. He says that he'd like to hear about your mutation, but only if you want, and only once his English is good enough to understand without a translator. I tried telling him you don't talk about it with anyone, but he says he knows this and the two of you have an agreement?
Gonch finishes with a curious look.
Sid rubs the back of his neck and smiles at Malkin helplessly in the face of his bright grin. Yeah, that's right, we do. Tell him it's a deal. Gaunch relays this, and Malkin's grin, impossibly, brightens more. He rattles off something else quickly in reply.
Ah, yes, Gaunch says, and he would like to share his mutation with you now, if no one is uncomfortable.
He addresses the last bit to the Lemieux family, who are standing together and watching with matching curious expressions. Mario nods his assent.
That'd be fine, as long as it won't damage the house or anything.
It won't, Gaunch says, resigned. But he will need to go outside.
To Sid's shock, Malkin leaves his spot behind Gaunch's shoulder in order to grab Sid's hand and starts tugging him outside. Sid follows, only briefly distracted by the flash of Malkin's death vision, so gray and blurred he can't make out a single detail, and considerably more distracted by the warm, dry press of their hands together. Malkin smiles at him over his shoulder, a little more hesitant this time, and says something low and soft. Gaunch either doesn't hear or doesn't bother translating. They make it outside, Malkin tugging him out onto the lawn, and the rest of the party following behind and clumped on the porch. Malkin motions for Sid to stop, then heads a few steps further onto the grass and turns his face up, looking nervous and excited. Sid makes sure his own face isn't doing anything stupid. For about half a minute, nothing happens. The weight of it stretches on awkwardly as they stand there waiting for Malkin to do something. Malkin, for his part, doesn't seem overly discomfited, just patient and a little preoccupied, like he's waiting for a bus to arrive. Sid's just starting to wonder if he's missing something important, if he's the only one not seeing it, when, out of the clear sky, a black cloud of birds swoops in and dives down, swarming Malkin, so much so that for a second he's completely obscured from view. One of the Lemieux girls shrieks, maybe with delight, maybe with fear. Sidney can't blame her. He's knocked breathless at the sight himself. It's quickly obvious that Malkin's not the victim of a freak bird attack. His happiness is visible and uncomplicated, and though the bird's wings brush against him familiarly, no beaks or little scritchy claws get near to tearing into him. His arms are loose at his sides, his face is tilted up, his expression one of contentment, and a little bit of pride as his flock swirls around him. It's a moment of pure magic. Eventually, the birds settle, some on the lawn and a couple on Malkin himself, perching on his shoulders and his head and pecking affectionately at his hair. Up close, Sid can see that they aren't actually black in color, but red and brown. Cardinals, he thinks. One of the birds on the ground flits up to land on Malkin's hand. He brings it in close to his face to croon at it and stroke its head with a gentle finger.
That's incredible, Sid breathes. Can you communicate with them? Is that it?
Malkin just smiles at him, a bit confused around his eyes, and Sid remembers they don't understand the same language. Gaunch wanders up next to them, his expression softer than Sid's seen from him except when he's talking about his family. He translates Sidney's questions to Malkin.
It's called animal affinity, he passes on after listening to Malkin's smooth Russian. Animals are drawn to him, innately fond of him. He can communicate with them in a basic, limited way, and he says he's found that they respond to his energy and emotions, bringing him food when he's hungry, comforting him when he's upset, that type of thing.
That's incredible, Sid says again. I can't even imagine. So it's all animals, then, not just birds? You have an amazing mutation. He enthuses to Malkin sincerely, and Malkin beams at him once Gaunch translates. For the first time he can remember, Sidney truly wants to share his mutation with someone, if only for something to bind the two of them together in this moment. He maybe understands Ovechkin's fellow mutant thing a bit better. Not that he would have wanted to share this with Ovechkin. Malkin, though, he thinks he would. But he still feels a pause. His mutation isn't the sort of thing that gets the same breathless delight that Malkin sparks. Sid's is creepy, not something to be shown off and celebrated. Despite this, he knows he'll still share it when Malkin's English is up to it. But he'll do it quietly,
without the audience and the display. He worries that Mulkin might not react favorably to what he can do, but at the same time he can't imagine not sharing this with him. He wants to feel the connection, the two-way trust, that vulnerability. He doesn't usually like feeling vulnerable, but in this case he thinks he understands. Maybe he'll change his mind, he reminds himself, dialing his enthusiasm back down. Maybe he's just imagining the tug between them. Maybe being fellow mutants, fellow teammates, won't be enough. Mulkin gestures with one palm. Three birds, all a sharp red, dart up and sweep towards Sydney. He doesn't flinch as they land on the forearm he reflexively holds up, but it's a close thing.
"Sydney Crosby," Mulkin says, grinning a little. "Birds like."
His accent is weighty and his voice sounds heavier and deeper in English. Sid laughs and ducks his head to look closer at the birds, not wanting to startle them away. They eye him placidly. "I'm not sure about that," he says, keeping his voice soft and not threatening. He's always liked animals, in part because he doesn't see death visions from them. But his whole life they've been restless and wary at best towards him, sometimes outright terrified. He thinks it has something to do with his specific mutation, something deathly about him they can sense. Whatever has possessed these birds to contentedly come near him now, it obviously has more to do with Mulkin than him. When he says as much, Mulkin looks to Gonch for a translation, and a brief exchange of Russian follows.
"He says no, they definitely like you," Gonch says after a minute, looking resigned. "He doesn't force them to do anything they don't want."
He sighs heavily, throwing Mulkin a long-suffering glance. "He just thought about you being a good person, and they agreed and wanted to see you." Sid looks up at the birds, startled, his cheeks probably as red as their feathers. Mulkin laughs happily at him. He's spared from coming up with a response as some of the Lemieux kids venture closer and ask if they can hold the birds. The next 10 minutes are spent with Mulkin patiently showing the kids how to hold their arms for the birds to perch, gently nudging them into form, wearing a pleased, proud smile whenever the birds flutter up to greet them. It's all just a little too sweet, honestly.
"What a remarkable mutation," Natalie murmurs, slipping up beside Sydney. She leans in for a closer look at the birds who have made him their perch, now on his shoulders, having migrated up when his arm got tired.
"I've never seen one quite like it."
"It's amazing," he agrees softly, gushingly. She gives him a small smile, but doesn't say anything else, content to give the birds a friendly little coo.
Natalie is the only other person in Pittsburgh, aside from Mario and the team executives, who know what he does. She's never flinched away or anything like that, but occasionally he catches her looking at him with sad eyes, and sometimes that's almost as bad. It reminds him too much of his mom. She gives his arm a squeeze and steps away.
"All right, everyone," she raises her voice. "Say thank you, then go in and get washed for dinner. Lots of soap, I mean it."
The kids go grudgingly as the group transfers inside, only Mulkin and Sydney lingering back. Birds swarm Mulkin once more, and Sydney can hear him whispering a few soft words in Russian. Then, with no visible urging from Mulkin, the birds lift off back into the sky. Sydney watches them go, face raised.
"I wonder if your mutation will be easier for you to get along with the team," he says as the birds turn into flecks and fade away.
"We are penguins, I mean." Mulkin frowns at him, obviously lost.
"Penguins?" he repeats, gesturing between the two of them.
He laughs. "Yeah," he says. "Penguins." Mulkin grins back.
The end.